Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I'm
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry, because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer at the buzzer. Jamarion Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. but I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you're right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
as
you're driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm coming along. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their.
All right, then. We're here for another installment of It's My House. And it's Black History Month, but here on It's My House, we have a niche. We have a couple of two or three niches. We declare it Slave Entrepreneur Month. Slave Entrepreneur Month, where we feature people who started out legally as slaves that became wealthy, and some of them, many of them became entrepreneurs and some wealthy entrepreneurs, and also Black Towns History Month, as well as Slave Artesian Month. And when we go with the Artesians basically were people who had, they made brooms, they made dresses, they were tailors, they were dressmakers, seamstresses, shipbuilders, house builders, you name it, even bridge builders. And they got their money together. And this is during, when slavery was still legal here in what we now call the United States. And they went over to Africa and started their own nation. In any event, today it's titled Slave and Jim Crow Wealth Metrics. Slave and Jim Crow Wealth Metrics. When people wealth can be measured in many different ways. Most commonly, people measure it by the government-issued legal tender. In other words, so-and-so's a millionaire. Well, a millionaire can be broke these days. And, depending on, for instance, you can be technically a millionaire by owning $1 million house in San Francisco or New York City or Chicago, someplace like that. But property might be assessed at $1 million, but if you've got a mortgage on it, you're not living like some people think millionaires should live. So we're going to take a look at the wealth metrics slaves that got free, and the Jim Crow era of blacks also, not all but many. We're gonna look at their wealth metrics, and then because I'm going by their wealth metrics. I'm going by what some of these escaped slaves who accumulated wealth. I'm looking at their wealth metric. All right, it wasn't necessarily in dollars, but it can be transferred into whatever currency or whatever kind of wealth that you want to transfer it into. So we're going to go through that. If you're on Blog Talk Radio in our scrolling marquee, we're going to have we got a few topics that will be covered, and I'll go over them right now just briefly. We'll touch on Madam C.J. Walker, her wealth metrics, slave entrepreneur factories, community-based businesses, Booker T. Washington information, and natural resources, millionaires and billionaires. So we'll be right back after this. And remember, you can call us at 619-768-2945 if you want to participate or offer any comments or suggestions.
Keep me wondering why, when that I must be dreaming, can't be real. You're not here with me. See, but I can feel you're near to me. Yeah. I caress you, let you taste the just so blissful. Listen, I would give you
wealthy, and you had a number of people that lived during the Jim Crow era, black, that they became wealthy too. So we're going to look at their wealth metrics, because that's a discussion that most people, when they talk about black history, they don't talk about wealth metrics, even today in 2022, regardless of what color, race, religion you are. Most people, in my opinion, measure wealth in a very, very limiting and restrictive way. They're using the United States dollar or some, you know, a euro or a pound or something like that, some government-issued legal tender. They're measuring wealth that way for the most part, okay? Or using the term, well, so-and-so is a millionaire. But there's a whole lot of broke millionaires. That might sound crazy, but they are. You know, they have all these debts, you know, credit card debt and all this other stuff. Or so-and-so was a billionaire. You know, but how much debt it goes behind that. I think you need to measure, use billionaires in a different light, because there's less than 3,000 of them on the planet. But in any event, so let's look at some wealth metrics here. we'll start off, and this we have some of this in our program notes, our topics covered. Let's start off with Madam C.J. Walker, who was not the first black millionaire, nor was she the first black female millionaire in the United States, or black female millionaire in the United States. But anyway, let's take a look at her wealth metric, okay? And let me all right. Let's take a person, if you're working a 9-to-5 job and you're getting paid by the hour, the wealth metric that you're using for that 8-hour job is, it could be a salary, which is a set amount of money, no matter how many hours you work. You know, in other words, you're going to be earning $1,000 a week. That's your salary, whether you work 4 hours a week or 80 hours a week. That's your salary, okay? Or the wealth metric could be I'm earning, $25 an hour or $200 an hour, and I'm working 8 hours a day. So the metric that you're using is per hour, dollars per hour, pounds per hour, euros per hour, Swiss francs per hour, yen per hour. All right. Now, the slaves that became entrepreneurs, the slaves who became wealthy, most of them were artisans. For those who don't know what is an artisan, artisan is somebody who makes something by hand. All right. And some of these people got, when they, you know, they, some of the things that they made were brooms. You know, you had people that made dresses, you know, seamstresses, tailors who made clothes. You had artisans, craftsmen, who were carpenters. They made furniture. They produced products. So they measured their wealth by what they made. They made a piece of furniture, a bed, a table, a chair, a house, a chicken coop, a dress, a pair of pants, a shirt, a wedding dress, a hat, some shoes. That was their wealth that they can produce every day, depending on what the item was. As fast as they can produce it, that was their wealth. So they got paid by the wealth that they created from their hands. Some were shipbuilders, Paul Kaffee, shipbuilding. Every ship he built, that's how he got paid. He didn't work by the hour. He worked by the, what he produced, ships. That's his wealth metric. Now, he lived in the colonial, he was not a slave, but he lived in the colonial times. All right. Madam C.J. Walker, and you can look this up, you can fact check me. Madam C.J. Walker had a factory. And in her factory, she made her product, she made hair care products. She manufactured products. I have a picture of it on the scrolling marquee, but if you're not online, look it up online. Just type in any search engine. Madam C.J. Walker factory. The pictures will pop up. She manufactured hot combs. She manufactured conditioners. She manufactured hair care products for hair. She manufactured products for the professional beautician or people to use it for private use at home. her wealth metrics were factories that she owned. Her wealth metrics were the products that she produced, the soaps, the conditioners, the hot combs. Those were her wealth metrics. When you got a factory and you're producing like she was producing, that dwarfs anything. It just obliterates working for no matter what amount of money per hour. A lot of people followed Madam C.J. Walker and became salespeople because they measured their wealth as far as, you know, all right, here's a beauty kit, a business in a box that was stocked with so many products, including hot combs and conditioners and soaps and hair treatments, scalp treatments, a business in a box. That was their wealth metrics, and there are plenty of people that fed their families with these beauty kits. Slave entrepreneur factories. Now, there were some slave entrepreneurs, and I'm going to take something real simple, that made brooms. You know, one by one, or made quilts, one by one. But then there was some enterprising ones that took it a step or two more and, you know, would set up their own factory. And it could be simple factories that you can relate to today. You know, let's sit around the table, the kitchen table factory, the backyard factory, the bedroom factory. That strategy worked 200-400 years ago. It still works today. It could be one or two people helping you, but you're not just relying on yourself. So that's another wealth metric. A community-based business, and I'm going to use Tuskegee as this one. I highly recommend read that. Well, you don't have to read it. You can go online now. You can go on YouTube and type it into the YouTube search engine, Chapter 10, Up from Slavery, and that's by Booker T. Washington. In that Chapter 10 of Up from Slavery, the wealth metric he used to build that university, and mind you, Tuskegee Institute, or university as they call it today, started out in a dilapidated shack, a shed. That's how they started. Get a visual on that. Here's a university. I mean, they're starting a school of higher education, and they're starting out their first building, their first classroom, is a dilapidated shed. I don't make this stuff. Read it for yourself. It's all online. Document. So one of the wealth metrics that they had, because they had a student body. They had a handful of students, which is human capital, human resources, and also social capital. All right, we got this dilapidated building. One of our first lessons is, let's get it cleared out so we can sit down. Now, they had to make furniture. They had to invent stuff to have it available. Then somebody, and this always happens, somebody says, well, what if we do this, or we can make this by doing that? That's called intellectual capital. That's a form of wealth, too. Ideas, I consider ideas, that's one of my wealth metrics. and you take that intangible idea and then you turn it into something physical. That's what they did in the early days of Tuskegee. Now, the ball really started rolling. This is why Chapter 10, you need to read it and or listen to it online on YouTube. They had to learn how to make bricks, and they had to learn how to make their own nails. They didn't know nothing about how to make that stuff at first. But they learned how to make it, bricks and nails, and they got so good at it, not only were they making their own materials to build their buildings at Tuskegee Institute in the early days, but then they became the sole brick mason company and nail maker in that particular county, and the majority, they got so good at that craft that their primary customer base was white folks during the Jim Crow era. So another wealth metric would be ideas, your community, because essentially under the direction of Booker T. Washington, they started a community-based business at Tuskegee to make those bricks and make those nails and then build those buildings. That was a community-based business, and that's a business model that many Amish and many Mennonite people and many Native Americans use to this day in 2022. All right, what else do we have here? William Levitt. Look him up. William Levitt and his brother and his father, Levitt and Sons, at one time when he was living, because he's no longer in this, his energy form is transmuted. He was building his company, him and his brother and his father, his dad, they were building 30 to 40 houses a day. That's another wealth metric. So, you know, you think in these terms. How many brooms can you produce per day? How many quilts can you produce per day? Matter of fact, let me just scope it down to 1 hour. Matter of fact, I'm gonna give a quick assignment to somebody here listening. When you find answers, call us up at 619-768-2945. Give us an answer. Here's the metric I want you to look up. How many hamburgers does McDonald's make per second or per minute? Once again, this is the wealth metric I want you to look up. How many hamburgers does McDonald's produce per second and or per minute? Because we need to do some paradigm shift thinking here. You know, how many dresses can you make per day? You know, I play on here quite often, and I know some of you are tired of hearing it, but there's a method behind my own madness. Factory City. I bought a copy of that, the digital copy, for my personal use. But you can go on YouTube and look at it for free, to your heart's content. In Factory City, it's all about wealth metrics. How many coffee pots can they produce per hour or in a day? How many irons can they produce? See, I don't think in terms of how much money I can earn an hour. Where I'm working, where I'm transforming myself is how, like a William Levitt, how many solar homes can I produce per day? And then eventually, how many solar homes can we produce per hour? Fender guitars, started by Leo Fender. I think they produce 35 guitars a day. You can break that down to they produce about 10 guitars every 15 minutes. And of course, once you got the finished product, you can sell it. or traded for everybody, whatever you want. So a lot of these slaves are people that started out as slaves and got wealthy via the Underground Railroad. And these black folk that got wealthy during the Jim Crow era, they got wealthy because their wealth metric was producing something tangible that they could sell or exchange for any type of currency or any type of goods or services that they needed. If you made a quilt, you can exchange it for dollars, you can exchange it for rubles, you can exchange it for pounds, euros, you can exchange it for so many loaves of bread, you can exchange it for groceries, you can exchange it for a coat, a hat, a goat, a pig, a dog. If you produce something, you got options. Okay. Toyota, their wealth metric is car production. And they crank out, on average, 30 cars per minute. And how they started, this is a family business, how they started was great-great-grandfather Toyota. He was making looms, you know, so people can make clothes. Social capital is a wealth metric. Mother Priscilla Baltimore, and you can read about her online. We've covered her at least 3-4 times on here over the years, including earlier this month. Her wealth metric, or one of her wealth metrics, was social capital. She worked to free herself from slavery, and then she worked to free other family members out of slavery. And then she got together with 11 other families, and they went and bought land and started their own town, Brooklyn, Illinois. Social capital, your ability to get along with other people, friends, relatives, that type of thing, is a very powerful, that's real Social Security. If you got to go to the Social Security Services office, and I'm not judging that, I'm not knocking that, you're more likely socially bankrupt or very close to it. Many black townships were started using the wealth metric of social capital, also known as cooperative economics. It's a wealth metric. Relationships are more important than money. But those relationships can be converted into money or anything you need. Going back to the Mother Priscilla Baltimore thing, I'm sure within that 11 family, group of 11 families that went over to Illinois and bought land, you know, somebody was good at, I'm sure they had a few carpenters in there. I'm sure they had more than 9 friends out of 11 families. That's why I play the 9 friends video, audio so much. It's a wealth metric. They had somebody that knew how to grow food. They had people in that group that knew how to forage for food until they can plant a crop and they can harvest it. Everything they needed was within that 11 family metric of social capital, and they didn't need a bank. They didn't need the government. Once again, real security is your ability to get along with your fellow man. But most people, when they get a little money, look, a couple of months ago, I talked to somebody. They got beat up over an EBT card, man. Come on. I mean, you know, but for some people, that's their wealth metric. And I'm not knocking an EBT card. But the social, oh, wait a minute, people. I'll be right back.
Hello, this is Greg Allison from Green Greg's Garden and Worm Farm, coming to you from a town that's for sale, yes, from the Farmer's Cotton Warehouse in Timsboro, Georgia. Yes, this town is for sale. That's one property. There's a syrup mill over here. There's an old abandoned depot here. There's a hotel across the street in the downtown center, too. We'll have to take a little tour here. Why would somebody want to buy a town, especially an old run-down ghost town almost? Well, it might be a great place for a micro-community. Hey, look at all this. This is for sale. There's several houses, old businesses, the downtown center. That's the old hotel there. And it's got a syrup mill. There's a grist mill. There's a shop back here. There's several houses and other businesses that are all apparently part of this property that's for sale. Check this out. That'd make a nice little restaurant business place right there. Maybe a brewery. And here's the syrup mill that could go with it. Maybe a sorghum syrup mead. I don't know. That might be a whole new twist on things. So if you want a micro community, a place to start might be a town that's for sale. And good thing about here is that stuff grows. There's moisture. There's rain. Several acres for sale, farmland and such, forest land, that you might could do something with. This area is also an area with a lot of strip mines, where they mine mineral that's used for making porcelain and things like that, the stuff you gloss paper with. It's basically a clay. So we'll take a tour. We'll look around this place a little bit. Okay, I'm in my vehicle now. So let's check this out.
Okay, I had to take care of some social capital myself. I got a guy that he needs me to check on his pet. I'm babysitting for a pet pig for a week or two, and he was giving me some instructions. So I'm keeping my social capital going in that way. In any event, let me play Nine Friends, and we'll be back right after that.
I say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew.
It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning.
It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together.
Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning.
He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family gonna live in there? Is they gonna, I'm gonna get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Okay, we've been talking, the reason why I play that, because that short audio, a couple of minutes, is a real simple wealth metric. All right, this guy, there were no paychecks here, man. There's nobody talking about, I got to get paid $15 an hour, I got to get paid $20. He had enough social capital where people came over with their own resources and helped out. Now, I'm sure out of those 9 pickup trucks that came over, somebody had beer, others had refreshments. They had probably had a potluck. So people got to eat. They got to drink. Everybody had enough to eat, full bellies all the way around the table. Okay. Work on a group project with friends, maybe family too. And as the guy said, the house looked brand new. Their wealth metrics are family, friends. They have people with skill sets in there. There were multiple wealth metrics in that. I looked up McDonald's, how many burgers. McDonald's, they sell around 75 hamburgers per second. And let me see. That breaks down to 4,500 burgers every minute. They sell 270,000 burgers every hour. That's a wealth metric. Now, another wealth metric would be natural resources. Natural resources. And how many acres of land a person might have? How many trees on that land? How much water, underground water, is on that land? How much water falls on that land? Matter of fact, here's a simple wealth metric that everybody can measure. On average, house, the average rainfall, as far as liters go, if you measure in liters, is like 40 to 43,000 liters of water falls on a house. However, most people don't even think about, how can I harness this rainwater and convert it into some type of wealth that I can use? Or maybe even monetize and sell it out to people. In other words, you got 43,000. If you got 43,000 liters of water falling on your house, you really should not be going to the store and buying water. There's no need for you to go out and buy Dasani, Fiji, any of those waters that you buy at a gas station, a grocery store, you name it. But most people are conditioned that I even think in wealth metrics like this. You're looking at somebody else's wealth metric, and you're trading your dollars for their wealth. Whereas you've got over 43,000 acres of, excuse me, not acres, 43,000 liters of wealth called rain dropping on top of you. But if you don't know, you don't know. It's a natural resource. Matter of fact, here's one for you. We'll probably do a podcast on this. I probably will. You know, you need to think about becoming a natural resource millionaire or billionaire. Well, round it out with this one. Sarah Rector, and you can look her up online. She was a natural resource tycoon. She had like 80 acres of land and discovered oil on that land. But there are other resources, natural resources, besides oil. Taking the natural resource of urine and making millions from it. In any event, hopefully I've opened up somebody's mind or broadened somebody's horizon on wealth metrics. Well, we're going to play Factory City here. And it's the whole thing is about what their wealth metrics, man. You got to produce something. You need some cash, you're short on cash, you got a financial condition that you need to clear up. What's your wealth metric?
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe, but they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but Yupa wants more. Little wonder Liu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627.
it attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly lines. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Li.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa Management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done. And when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Lee runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals. He's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees.
Okay, all right, we played enough of that. Anyway, but we played Factory City, which you can watch on YouTube for free. I bought a digital copy via Amazon. But today, once again, this is Slave Entrepreneur Month and Blacktown's History Month. Today we covered slave early in the program, and I'm going to review it right now. Slave and Jim Crow wealth metrics. And let me break that down even further. Slave wealth metrics and Jim Crow wealth metrics. Once again, and we're going to concentrate on this week because a lot of people measure wealth differently. They measure wealth differently. And some people, and due to the fact that we measure wealth differently, some of us could be standing in the middle of, thing by Russell Conwell, acre of diamonds, but if we don't recognize what we're standing in the middle of, the wealth that we're standing in the middle of, we're not going to make it. So Many slaves, not all, just like today, many, and this once again, this is legally people that were legally born slaves. Those who became entrepreneurs, they measured wealth differently than those that didn't become entrepreneurs. And then the ones that became wealthy slave or formerly slave entrepreneurs, because like Junius George Groves, and we covered him week one here on It's My House. Here's a guy that was born a slave, but he recognized the wealth, the natural wealth that can be grown, that can be created through planting potatoes. He became a potato farmer, and later on he became known as the king of potato farmers or whatever. I mean, he produced more bushels of potatoes than anybody on the planet at that time when he was living. He became very wealthy by the white man's standards. But his wealth metric was measured, you know, in potatoes. All right. I consider a vegetable a natural resource. Matter of fact, when I want you to the next time, just go online if you don't have any handy. And then take a look at a seed. I mean, look, the next time you eat an apple, hopefully it's got some seeds in it, or orange got some seeds in it. Take a look at that seed. Are you looking at just the seed, or are you looking at an orchard? Because every seed contains orchards within it. And Junius George Groves, that's how he went from former slave to wealthy entrepreneur, because he saw his wealth metric was measured in that potato versus, you know, making whatever per hour or per day, whatever they were making back then. All right. Sarah Rector, she had 80 acres of land that was deemed good for farming, but she had the natural resource, and natural resources is a wealth metric. Because a lot of people, if it's not in dollar and cents, or pounds or euros or drachma or rubles or whatever, you know, a lot of people miss a lot of opportunity. You know what? A lot of people are walking past not only millions, but probably billions of dollars or whatever way you're going to measure a day, because they don't have the correct wealth metric to recognize things. You know, there's somebody making millions of dollars off of urine and poop because they set up these, these Johnny on the spots for people that, you know, that might be at a picnic or a fest or something like that. You know, they collect the poop and the poo, and then I'm sure they sell that to somebody who knows what to do with it, how to monetize it. So a lot of these former slaves, people that were born slaves that became wealthy entrepreneurs, they just had a different wealth metric than the common everyday person then. Even today in 2022, and let's go to the Jim Crow era. Now, one of the examples that I've used today was Madam C.J. Walker. Her wealth metric was, now, she could have taken a job doing somebody's hair and getting paid so much money per day to do somebody's hair. Because a lot of people, you know, I'll work for $50 a day, or I'll work for $100 a day or $200 a day. That's their wealth metric. They're measuring it in dollars per hour or dollars per day. But the metric that Madam C.J. Walker used was in production of product. Once again, go online and put in any search engine, Madam C.J. Walker factory. And then the pictures will pop up. Her wealth metric was in factories. You know, a factory that produces, that produce hot combs, because hot comb is a wealth metric. How many hot combs could she make and then turn around and sell? She had a sales force that she sold to. That's human capital. That's another wealth metric. Making scalp treatments. You know, how many scalp treatments? Because let's use the factory city thing that I just played for the gazillion time. Okay, how many hot combs did Madam C.J. Walker crank out a day? Whatever she cranked out of the day was probably more than the average person at that time, black or white, earned in a year. But she cranked it out in a day. Matter of hours. That was her wealth metric. How much product and how many products. And I'm going to do some research on that because she had an extensive product line. Hot combs, scalp treatments, shampoos, conditioners, different types of soaps, different type of lotions. She had a factory because she needed that factory to make her. That was her wealth metric, all wrapped into one. And then how many factories did she own? So that's another wealth metric. And she's one of my Jim Crow millionaires. Now, anybody could have did the same thing because Madam C.J. Walker was her professional name. Her birth name was Sarah Breedlove. But her professional business name was Madam C.J. Walker. So I want you guys to take a look at, like I say, chapter 10 of the book, Up from Slavery, where Booker T. Washington, he lays out some of the wealth metrics that they had to launch that university. And he recognized that, and he started off life legal as a slave. They started off, and you can read it for yourself, they started off in a dilapidated shed. But they turned that shed into capital. And they used the students and other teachers who were human resources, human capital, to upgrade it and make it into a classroom. And some of the things, some of the wealth metrics that they used through using their own labor and teaching these kids or their students at Tuskegee at the time, the building trades or the furniture trades, they made their own furniture. See, one of the problems, social problems that's happening today is, like, you take somebody that might be a member of a gang, you pick the city, okay? A youth that might be typically a male that's a member of a street gang, I'm going to throw something out there that you can pretty much bank on. Number one, there's nobody in that gang that knows how to make any furniture. They don't know how to make a table, a chair. They don't know how to make a bed to sleep on. They don't know how to make soap. They don't know how to make anything that can be made in a day or so that they can turn around and sell or exchange, because exchange is a better thing. They can exchange, like, let's take somebody that knows how to make a bed. All right. And they know how to make a bed. They can make it in a day. Matter of fact, let's take somebody who's flat broke. I got one of my Facebook buddies in Kenya. True story, I'm going to get her on here. She was flat broke in Kenya, a developing country. And she needed to eat. So she she can get for free. Because Kenya had, at the time, they still might have, they had some government ordinance where you couldn't harvest any trees. But she didn't know how to make, she wasn't a carpenter at the time. But she took some pallets and she learned, she taught herself how to make furniture. And she started selling something, and the better she got, the more of it. She's got employees now. Wealth Metrics. All right, well, we're going to wrap it up for today. We'll be back tomorrow with, we're going to be covering Wealth Metrics, particularly from the slave point of view and the Jim Crow era, all this week. Because you can take some of that philosophy and find your whatever you need this week. So on that point, everyone have a good rest of the day. I think today is what, President's Day? So it's like a, I guess, a de facto holiday. No mail delivery today. Although most businesses are open. I don't know, schools in some places might be closed, in other places they might not be closed. In any event, have a good, safe, and safe holiday. And we'll see you tomorrow with more Slave Wealth Metrics and Jim Crow Wealth Metrics.